The title of tonight's talk is How to Build Healthy Community Economies. I have probably about 24 PowerPoint presentations, and it's always a difficult decision for me to figure out which one is appropriate. But I think this will follow on nicely from the one that I did the other night. This will be more specifically related to building community economies. And I think that might be most pertinent to Oroville-ians at this point in time. Well, the global economy may or may not be sinking. However, in any event, it's incumbent upon us to build healthy communities, and you can't have a healthy community without a healthy economy. This is a definition of community that I like. It came from Michael Linton, who is the originator of the LETS system. He says, an effective community is a process, an ongoing collection of interactions and continuing relationships. And I think that pretty much sums it up. The defining characteristics of a community are economic and cultural self-sufficiency. Now, even though there's a great thirst for community, people generally do not understand how conventional money and banking are corrosive to the social fabric. And when the mother said there should be no money in Oroville, I think that's what she meant. Those systems preempt community self-determination. So we have to find a way to regain at least some measure of self-determination. One of the economists that I admire most is Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs said that national economies are not the salient entities. It's cities that are the salient economic entities. And I brought a couple of Jane Jacobs' books to put in your library, and those are available to you. So it's the economies of cities and their economic regions upon which the health of national and global economies depend. Now, communities have common economic problems. First of all, local producers are forced to compete with outside producers that are subsidized, enjoy special privileges, or are not required to play by the same rules. So in the United States, for example, a large amount of our manufacturing capacity has gone offshore, mainly to the Central American countries, the Far East, Taiwan, China. Just about everything you find in the stores today in America is made in China. We have high environmental standards in the United States. We have good working conditions and good pay. These things were hard won after a long struggle. But now, because the economy is being globalized, all of these things are being negated by the fact that companies can go offshore and find labor that's cheap, find countries where they don't have to abide by strict environmental regulations and labor practices. Secondly, the terms of trade are dictated by these outside buyers and sellers who dominate the markets. If you take Walmart as an example, Walmart is the world's biggest company. It has stores in every little town around the United States and probably other countries as well. It buys in huge quantities, and it can drive a hard bargain in determining the prices of the things that it buys. Furthermore, money that comes into a community goes quickly out again because national currencies are pretty universal within a relatively large domain. The U.S. dollar in particular is a global currency, and it's pretty much accepted anywhere. And resources and wealth are siphoned off by absentee owners. This is an old story of the Banana Republic, where the resources are owned mainly by foreigners who exploit those resources and take the wealth back home, leaving little or nothing for the people who live there. It's true inside of countries as well. There's a region in the United States called Appalachia, which is parts of West Virginia and Kentucky, Tennessee, and it's a large coal mining region. So it has a lot of natural resources, and however, the people there are very poor, and they have been for as far as anybody can remember. And the saying around there is, how can the country be so rich and the people be so poor? It's all because of absentee ownership and the exploitation that that brings. So conventional money is problematic in a number of different ways. It adversely impacts the economy, the environment, and society. And it didn't take me long in my research on money and banking to come to that conclusion. Money and banking have been politicized. Money exists mainly as bank credit that has to be borrowed into circulation. So for every unit of currency that is in circulation, somebody had to go into debt to a commercial bank in order to create that money. The global monetary system has institutionalized usury, which creates a growth imperative. Now that requires a little bit of explanation. I say the global monetary system because it's all one system. Even though each country has its own central bank, every central bank operates pretty much on the same pattern, and those banks are all tied together within an international financial regime through the Bank for International Settlements and other international organizations. Since money has to be borrowed into circulation at interest, this creates an exponential growth function for debt. So if you look at the debt statistics, you find that debt has been growing exponentially for a long time. And, of course, nothing can grow exponentially forever. Either it has to level off or you have a catastrophic collapse. And this is well documented in many ecological studies where you have animal or insect populations that surge and then fall off catastrophically when they've outrun their food supplies. So I can't spend too much time on this, but you ought to realize that because of this debt imperative, everybody in the economy is trying to avoid defaulting on what they owe to the banks. And the only way they can do that is by increasing their output, their sales, and their profits. This is why we're tearing up the landscape, mining, logging, doing all these things that are destructive to the environment because everybody's trying to avoid defaulting on their debt. Of course, it's impossible. Under the debt money system, some must fail, even if they're well managed. So the global debt money system causes cancerous growth. Money is kept artificially scarce, but it goes to those that are well connected, and it goes to governments to fight wars and to allocate money to favored clients. The United States, again, is a prime example of this. The United States has gone $7 trillion into debt over the years, and that continues to grow. Every year the government runs a budget deficit, it has to borrow more money in order to cover the shortfall. But the government gets to borrow as much as it wants. If it wants to fight a war in Iraq, there's no problem. It just borrows the money into circulation, which of course is eventually inflationary, and it causes a debasement of the currency. So you and I pay for it, or all Americans pay for it, because the value of the currency is declining as a result. Now, the same thing happens in other countries too. I'm sure India is pretty much the same. Since we have to pay interest on it, money is expensive. Also, money is misallocated. So our task is to insulate, but not isolate, the community economy. so that we can reduce exploitation, enhance local economic vitality, enable local self-determination, and optimize the community's standard of living and quality of life, instead of having to participate in this race to the bottom by having to compete with low-wage countries like China and places where there are no environmental laws. The way globalization is being conducted these days, it's very destructive to communities and to small local economies. Now, I use the analogy of a small boat harbor. This is a picture of one in Hawaii. And a small boat harbor requires some protective barrier from the open sea so that the turbulence of the open sea does not destroy the boats. So we can compare a small boat harbor to a local economy. What kinds of seawalls can be built to make the local economy a safe harbor? Well, I've concluded that money is the key. Because the specialization of labor requires that we get what we need by trading with one another. It's very little of the things that we use that we make ourselves. We all specialize in one thing or another, and we try to earn money doing that and use that money to trade with one another to get all the other things that we need. Food, housing, clothing, and so on. Money is the thing that enables those trades to take place. But as I said before, money has been politicized and monopolized and made an instrument of power. So those who control money control everything else. It's the mother of all monopolies. So we have a fundamental need for exchange mechanisms that enable all desirable trades within the community to take place, that reduce business costs, that favor local suppliers over external suppliers, and that enable the community to control its own economy. Mutual credit associations and community currencies, I think, are a key strategy to employ because they provide exchange media that are abundant, community controlled, not controlled by some central bank somewhere, democratically allocated, interest-free, self-adjusting, stable and sustainable. Now, we could talk at length about that to explain all of those things, but I'll ask you to just take that on face value for the moment. So what we need to do is liberate the exchange process from this global money monopoly. There are two synergistic approaches. One is to create mutual credit clearing exchanges, which I spoke of the other night, and the other is to create complementary currencies issued privately and not by the central bank or government. Now, money, official money, that comes into a community quickly flows out again because a universal currency can go anywhere. And you can just as easily use rupees to buy your vegetables from two provinces away as you can to buy locally. So a local business might succeed in attracting some official money, and it might change hands once or twice within the community, but then it goes out again, and we're left with a shortage of exchange media once more. Community credits that we create ourselves, however, can recirculate over and over again within the community. Since it is a local currency, it's not likely to stray very far outside the community. And since it was issued locally, it has to come back into the local community for redemption in goods and services. So what is a mutual credit clearing exchange? An association of buyers and sellers that provides for the direct settlement of bills due to one another. It's common practice in business to operate on what's called open account. You sell to your customers on open account, which means you ship the goods and they pay you later. And you buy from your suppliers on open account. You receive the goods and you pay them later. So you have this time span within which there is the opportunity to sell the goods and be able to pay what you owe to your suppliers. Well, if you can envision a community of business people, and we're all business people in one way or another, even if it's only our labor that we're selling, we're buying and selling all the time. And so we can just keep an account where every time I sell something, my account is credited, yours is debited. And when I buy something, my account is debited and the seller's is credited. So in the long run, your account is going to fluctuate. The balance is going to go up and down. Sometimes it'll be positive, sometimes it'll be negative. But in the long run, it's going to average out around zero if it's properly managed. So we form such an association that enables bills to be paid without the use of money. Ultimately, it's goods and services that pay for other goods and services. Money is just the intermediary device that we use to facilitate the process. But we can create our own facilitating mechanism. So as I said, when you sell something, your account is credited. When you buy something, your account is debited. Now, some people say, well, what if somebody is always in the negative? That means they've bought more than they've sold. Well, if that is a concern, you can always settle accounts periodically, maybe once every 3 months or every 6 months or once a year. But managing a mutual credit clearing system is sort of like riding a bicycle. If you think about holding your balance on a bicycle when it's standing still, obviously you can't do it. It's the dynamic process, it's the moving forward that allows you to hold your balance on a bicycle. And it's the same way with a mutual credit system. As you move forward through time with this process, you learn how to keep the balance. So credit clearing systems are already in operation. There are numerous examples. There are commercial barter exchanges. They're not really barter. The correct terminology is trade exchanges, but everybody knows them as barter exchanges. And they provide for businesses to do business with each other without using official money. It's this clearing process that I spoke of. In the United States, there are many, many commercial barter exchanges that have members that pay substantial amounts of money to participate in this process, and in Europe as well. There's also the LET systems. At the grassroots level, we have credit clearing that has been established under this rubric of LETs. And there are many variations on that theme. It's hard to estimate how many there are, but there are probably at least 2,000 LET systems operating globally. Here's again the pictorial representation of how this works. So the oval represents the Mutual Credit Clearing Association. And the smiling faces are the members of that association. So the whole process begins when an issuing member buys something from another member. And then that can happen several times, and then those credits can be circulated within the group. Now, there are a number of ways of doing this. The most common is the account ledger. You just have a set of accounts. Each person has an account. And this can be done on paper. It can be done in a computer. When we first started the Tucson Traders Mutual Credit Clearing System, we just kept the accounts in a notebook. Each person had a page, and the page had the name and the account number, and then several lines where you could register the purchases and sales, and we would keep a running balance in the last column. And then once a month, we would just Xerox those pages and send them out to the account holders so that they had a statement of their situation at that point. Then eventually, the people that were managing the system said, "It's a lot of work keeping all these records. Why don't we just issue paper notes to everybody and let them pass notes from hand to hand as a way of keeping score instead of tracking every transaction?" So that has great advantages. It reduces the workload, and it also makes it possible to trade with people outside of the circle. Anybody who's willing to accept the paper notes, you can buy from them. So this shows how non-members can also participate in a clearing system. This is what we had before. Now we add outsiders. And a member can issue paper to an outsider, and that can circulate, but eventually it has to come back inside the circle to be redeemed for goods and services. Now, aside from any mutual credit clearing association, it's also possible to issue private currencies. A currency may be issued independently by a single company or a group of companies. Take, for example, Walmart again. Walmart's a big company. It has a lot of credibility, sells billions of dollars worth of merchandise every day. Suppose Walmart decided that it wanted to issue its own currency, and suppose it convinced its employees and suppliers to accept part of their pay in Walmart notes. Now, those Walmart notes would probably circulate hand to hand quite readily, because anybody accepting them would know that they could take them to Walmart and spend them just as they would official cash. That would be a single issuer situation. But you can have a collective issue that's put out by several issuers in an association together. And I'll say more about that in a minute. Such currencies are best issued by offering them as payment to suppliers and employees. They're spent into circulation as opposed to being sold. In the visitor's account, I have to buy credits with rupees. That's selling a currency for official cash. Now, that has a place. It can be useful. But the most powerful community currency is one that is spent into circulation, not exchanged for official currency. Some basic principles. Every currency is a credit instrument, or IOU. IOU doesn't translate very well in some languages, but it's I-O-U. So even rupees, even these paper notes are credit instruments. They're something that is owed to you by the Central Bank of India. And in the United States, the currency is Federal Reserve notes. If I have Federal Reserve notes in my pocket, it means the Federal Reserve owes me that amount of money. So it's a credit instrument. Well, if the central bank can issue a credit instrument, so can we. So a currency can be issued by a business, a municipal government, or an association of those entities. Now, what is the basis of issue? Of course, you have to be able to redeem your issue in goods and services. So you have to be producing value of some kind. As a municipality, you're producing value by providing services. As a business, you're providing goods or services of some kind. Airlines, railways, manufacturing companies, they're all producing something of value that people want. So that can be the basis of issuing a currency. The currency is ultimately redeemable only for goods and services in the marketplace. Now, what do municipalities have? They anticipate tax revenues and they charge fees for their services. So that can be the basis of issue for a municipal currency. Businesses provide goods and services. That's their basis of issue. And likewise, associations of those entities can issue currencies. So it's the ability of the issuer to produce valuable goods and services that enables them to issue a currency. If I offered you a currency, but you had no assurance that I was going to be in business tomorrow, you probably wouldn't accept it. So we want to be able to pay employees and suppliers when we issue the currency. Another benefit of it, besides the ones I mentioned earlier, is it provides an interest-free form of financing. Instead of borrowing official money in order to finance our operations, we can issue our own currency. So here you have a pictorial representation. You got a business or municipal issuer on the right. On the left, you've got workers and suppliers. And at the bottom, you've got all the merchants in the community. So we start out with the business or municipal issuer issuing a community currency in exchange for labor, services, or supplies. Now the workers and suppliers who receive that currency spend it with the local merchants, and the local merchants can exchange it among themselves. And finally, they can bring it back to the issuer in payment for the issuer's goods and services. So whenever you think about a currency or a credit system, you have to have this complete circuit. If the circuit isn't completed, you have a failure of reciprocity. Now this shows a plumbing diagram. And basically when we talk about circulation, we're talking plumbing. You have the issuer at the top there, and you have issuance into circulation. So the tank there in the green represents the currency credits or notes that are outstanding, that are in the hands of people in the community. And I show a valve there at the top to indicate that this issuance process is controlled. It can be slowed down or speeded up as necessary. Likewise, you have currency credits coming out of circulation as they go back and are redeemed by the issuer. So we can think of this as the money supply. That green level in the tank is the money supply of community currency. It can go up or it can go down. You want to have just the right level. You don't want the tank to run dry, and you don't want it to overflow. So we are developing a superior exchange medium, if you compare issuing a currency with borrowing money from the bank, both give rise to a liability on your balance sheet. But when you take a loan from the bank in rupees, you're promising to pay that amount plus some interest later on. Now, it's a very speculative thing as to whether you're going to be able to have those rupees to pay when the loan comes due. On the other hand, when you issue your own currency, redeemable for your own goods and services that are your stock in trade, you have pretty good assurance that you're going to have that available to redeem your currency. Because you control your production process. You don't control the official money supply of rupees. Your credits are based on the always available goods and service capacity of your business. So credits are locally created and controlled. They remain in the local area, so they promote buy local and strengthen the entire local economy instead of going outside. And the credits, if they are properly managed, will be accepted throughout the community by all merchants in payment for all kinds of goods and services. Now here's an example. Suppose $100,000 worth of community currency credits are spent into circulation by an association of businesses. That means that their collective cash expenditures have been reduced by $100,000. That's $100,000 in cash, in official money that they don't have to spend. That means their working capital can be reduced. Further, that $100,000 remains in the community instead of flowing out of the community to pay for imports. Second example. Actually, this is part of the same example, but a further elaboration. If the turnover of this currency in the community is 10 times a year, that means that there have been $1 million of additional sales within the community. Sales that might not have occurred otherwise, sales that would have gone to outside vendors instead. If the rate of profit on sales is 20%, that results in additional yearly profits of $200,000. Further, the issuance of community currency credits have enabled some interest-bearing debt to be retired. That $100,000 in community currency that was issued meant that you didn't have to borrow $100,000 from the bank, saving you interest. If the interest rate is 10%, that amounts to $10,000 in a year. So every dollar's worth of community currency credit that's issued means one less dollar needs to be borrowed and one less dollar that you have to pay interest on. So now to get down to issues, what is it that makes a currency credible and sound? First of all, a currency implies an agreement between the issuer and the receiver. If you accept my currency as payment for real value, let's say your goods or your services, that currency implies a contract between me and you. And the contract is that I will receive that currency back at face value or at par for whatever it is I sell. That's condition number one. Others are free to refuse it or discount it below face value. There must be no legal tender. Now, with a private currency, you can't have a legal tender unless the government favors you with such a law. And that's the case with official central bank currencies. The government says you must accept this currency at face value in payment of all debts, regardless of the true value of that currency. That's why we have inflation. Because the only way that you can protect yourself from an inflated currency is to raise your prices. And that's what inflation is. It's an increase in the general price level. The amount issued must be in proper proportion to anticipated sales and revenues. So if my annual sales are $1 million, I shouldn't be issuing $100 million of currency into circulation. It'd take me 100 years to redeem it all. And the amount of credit or notes in circulation should be continuously published so that people have the information they need to evaluate the currency and decide whether it's full value or not. That's right. Well, they're the government. They can do what they want. Yes, what he's referring to is the statement that one measure of the money supply will no longer be published. I think it's M3, was it? Yeah. So what are some examples or precedents? This has all been done before. It's nothing new. It hasn't always been done well. But during the 1930s Depression, there were hundreds of scrip issues in circulation in the United States. Thank you. They were issued by businesses. They were issued by municipalities. They were issued by bank clearing houses and various other entities as a way of making up for the shortage of official money at the time. That's what caused the Great Depression. There wasn't enough money in circulation. The banks restricted the money supply and caused a lot of people to go bankrupt, putting a lot of people out of work. Another example, Argentina in 2003, I was there for the second time. The provinces in Argentina were issuing their own currencies because the central bank, the central government, wasn't putting enough into circulation and it wasn't reaching the provinces. So the provinces were issuing their own currencies. Also, there was a phenomenon called the treque clubs or the trading clubs. This was a grassroots movement, sort of like Let's. There was dire economic circumstances in Argentina throughout the 90s, and it became even more severe in 2001. So people began to organize themselves into trading clubs, and they would trade without using pesos because they didn't have pesos. They made up their own little credito notes. They called them papayitos, or little papers. And Sergio and I were there at the same time in 2003, and we were there in 2001 as well. And we saw enormous trading fairs that went on every day of the week, hundreds of people coming to these large buildings, abandoned factories and warehouses, where they would set up their haircutting and set up their food stands and bring their stuff to sell, all with their own currencies. And there were probably three dozen different kinds of currencies. Now, unfortunately, a lot of those were not done correctly, and so eventually that caused a major collapse in that movement. But they're in the process of rebuilding now, and I'm hoping they'll do it better this time. Oh, the flaw. The flaws, well, there was some dishonesty. There was lack of transparency. There was some counterfeiting and general mismanagement. That there wasn't a great understanding of the monetary principles that you need to understand in order to do a proper system. Here's one of the provincial currencies. This one was from the province of Mendoza. Mendoza is an oil-rich province, and they get royalties on the petroleum extraction. So they issued these provincial bonds on the basis of the anticipated petroleum royalties. So the first barter club in Argentina was started in 1995, and then it expanded very quickly. And then when we had the financial collapse in 2001, people weren't even allowed to take their money out of the bank if they had money in the bank. So there was a huge upsurge of participation in these cheque clubs, and there wasn't time to orient them all properly. So it's like people jumping aboard lifeboats and swamping them, causing them to sink. And that's part of the reason why the cheque clubs and the crédito currencies collapsed. Another example of a successful mutual credit clearing association is the Virbank in Switzerland. This began during the Great Depression in the 1930s, and it was set up primarily for the small and medium-sized businesses in Switzerland. Again, there wasn't enough official money in circulation, so they created this mutual credit clearing association that they called the Wirtschaftsring. That is still in operation. Sergio and I were there last year to talk to people at the Virbank in Basel, Switzerland. They do billions of Swiss francs a year in clearing among several tens of thousands of businesses that are members of the Virbank. Like a what? Like a barter system. It's what people sometimes call a barter system, but barter is when two people have something the other wants and they make a trade. When you have a group of people, it's no longer barter. It's a reciprocal mutual credit system, because I can get what I want from you, but if I have nothing that you want, you have to go to someone else. So as soon as you bring a third person into it, it's no longer barter, it's credit clearing. And this is a good model to study. There has been an excellent book written about it. It's a small book. It was written by a Swiss professor at the University of Basel, and we met him last year. And unfortunately, the book was written in German, and it was only available in German. However, one of our colleagues has translated it into English, and we're looking for a publisher to publish the English edition. So, what are the stages of implementation for a mutual credit clearing circle? Well, the first thing is to organize a group of trusted issuers. Get the most popular, most profitable businesses in the community to start it. You want to start from strength. You want to establish credibility right from the beginning. Accept to membership other participants who are not given overdraft privileges. That means they're not issuing members, they're just they have an account in the system, but they have to earn before they spend. An issuing member can spend before they earn. Is that clear? Then persuade non-member local merchants to use the currency by accepting it. This will get the currency circulating throughout the community. Now, once the local merchants see that it is circulating well and easily passed on, other merchants will jump on the bandwagon, and pretty soon everybody in the community will be accepting the currency. So So when the mutual credit clearing circle is functioning smoothly and the currency has been widely accepted, then you can begin to ease the restrictions and offer overdraft privileges to more of the members, but only on the basis of demonstrated ability to sell value into the system. Now, one mistake that's often made with grassroots systems is that they rely on volunteer labor, and they don't charge enough in terms of fees in order to cover the expenses of operating the system. So what invariably happens with volunteers is they burn out. They get tired. They don't want to do it anymore. However, if people are getting paid, if they're being nurtured by the work they're doing, then they have the capacity to continue to do it. So you want to charge fees that are sufficient to pay for the costs of operations, and your administrators ought to be paid, maybe partly in local currency and partly in official currency. So some of your fees will have to be charged in cash, because you always have some cash expenses that you can't meet in local currency. Your administrative and sales personnel need to be paid, but part of their pay could be in the community currency. All the salaries have to be paid out of revenues generated from service fees, and system account deficits should be avoided or strictly limited. Let me emphasize that point. The system itself has an account within its system. One of the big mistakes that is often made is that when revenues are insufficient, the system itself will go deeply into the debit side, overdrawing its account beyond its capacity to pay. What happens in that event? Now you got the system itself issuing a lot of credits into circulation, but not redeeming them. Inflation, debasement of the currency. People are going to say, well, I'm finding it harder and harder to spend this currency. I don't want any more of it, thanks. Or they'll say, well, I'll take it, but at 80 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar. So this is a common pitfall that ought to be avoided. If the system has an account at all, the system balance should probably be in the positive all the time. Should not be allowed to go negative. So the question often arises, and must arise, how much currency can be issued? Well, the ultimate answer to that is determined by the market, but we have some ground rules and guidelines that we can point to. But the market is going to reflect the perceived credibility and value of the currency. When the currency begins to pass at a discount, the market is telling you that corrective action needs to be taken. Now, here's a pictorial representation of that. If you look at time on the horizontal and the value of the currency on the vertical, if the par value is $1, you want the currency to hold that value. You don't want it to sink below. Here it's sinking below, then getting back up, now sinking down again. And corrective action is taken to bring it back to par. If the issuance is excessive, you'll have a discount in the market, and your employees and suppliers will start refusing to accept any further amounts. People will lose confidence in the community currency and in alternative currencies generally. But private currencies are self-correcting. since they don't have the privilege of legal tender, when a currency begins to pass at a discount, whoever is issuing it is going to be adversely affected because people won't accept it in further amounts. So he has to clean up his act, so to speak. He's obliged to accept it back at par. So if you're buying, or if you're accepting the currency at 50 cents on the dollar, and I have to accept it at par, dollar for dollar, that itself is going to correct the imbalance, and it's going to force me to reduce my rate of issuance of new currency into circulation. So either I'm going to suspend issuance or I'm going to slow down the rate of issuance until the discount is eliminated. Now here's a historic rule of thumb that's been worked out over years by experience. They talk about a 1% daily reflux of currency. That means your currency ought to come back to you at a rate that allows you to retire it 1% each day, or in a 100-day period, retire the whole amount. That's a reasonable time span in which your debt would be redeemed. So if you've issued $100,000 into circulation, each day you have to be taking in $1,000.
But that's your measure of time to see that you are actually on the safe side.
Right. Yeah, if you've issued 100,000 and you're only taking in 500, you know you're in dangerous territory. So you ought to stop issuing more until you get that back into balance. Right, some are going to be redeeming more than they issued, and some are going to be redeeming less than they issued. Well, since this is a continuous process, like riding a bicycle, you make adjustments in the issuance privilege.
Okay, but you have a system that allows you to check all the issuers.
Yes.
For one day.
Yes. Yes. You have those records. If it's a computerized ledger system, you have up to the second the amounts and the balances of every issuer. So this translates into a volume of currency equivalent to about 3 months' sales revenues. So based on your total revenues of $40 million a year, applying the 1% daily reflux rule of thumb, you could issue about $10 million worth of credits into circulation. But there are other factors that are going to limit. Because most of your sales are still going to be cash sales, you have to consider what proportion of your expenditures are being made in local currency versus non-local currency. If much of your supply is coming from outside, chances are your outside suppliers are not going to want to accept the local currency if they don't buy a lot in the local community. Here's a typical balance sheet. I mentioned earlier that by issuing a community currency, we could reduce our bank borrowing. So if you notice on the right, you've got notes payable and other current liabilities, which are interest-bearing debts. We can substitute community currency credits for some of that debt. Now, the currency is non-interest-bearing, so whatever interest we were paying on those notes and other liabilities, we would save. So the issuance of credits enables retirement of some of that short-term debt. We can save interest, which could be a significant amount. And in this example, if you had $3 million at 10% for 7 years, if you had a note to the bank that you owed them $3 million payable in 7 years, the interest on that would be $300,000 a year, or $2 million in total. So if you could issue $3 million in local currency, you could save that amount of interest. Now, Jane Jacobs says that economies develop through import substitution. By producing more of what they use internally rather than buying it from outside. So this is another point. If we're talking about self-reliant economies, what we want to do is to reduce the amount that we import and produce more of what we use internally. This gives us more control over our quality of life and our standard of living. Now, trade with the outside will continue, but on different terms. We're no longer dependent as we were on outside entities, so we have more say over what happens in our community. Now, one other concept that's important here is the supply chain, as it's called. You have retailers, you have wholesalers, manufacturers, basic commodity producers, and employees. Now, ultimately, we need to include all levels of the supply chain in our clearing association. Because retailers need to pay wholesalers. And wholesalers need to pay manufacturers. And manufacturers get what they need from basic commodity producers. And of course, they all have employees. So we need to bring the employees into it. Again, we have to complete the circuit. And employees are key players in all of this. Ultimately, we need to bring employees into the system because employees are included at every level, from retailer to wholesaler to manufacturer and so on. It's human labor that provides the basis for the creation of all economic value. Now, I mentioned earlier that it's best if we can issue currency into circulation by spending it. But it can also be sold for cash. And that has some advantages, although not nearly as powerful an advantage as spending currency into circulation. By spending currency into circulation, we are not at all dependent on the policies of the central bank or how much rupees or dollars or euros might be in circulation. By selling a community currency for cash, you're totally dependent on the existence of cash. Still, it has a few advantages. Think about gift certificates. A gift certificate in the United States is a common phenomenon. I don't know if it is in this part of the world, but your friend is having a birthday and you would like to get her something nice, but you don't really know what she would like. So you go to the body shop or Victoria's Secret or one of those stores and you buy a gift certificate. And you give her the gift certificate. So now she can take that and go to the store and get whatever she wants, but only from that store. So you're creating a limited use currency in exchange for a universal currency. So when I buy rupees at the finance office here, it's basically a gift certificate. However, in this case, they will give me rupees back if I don't spend all of my credits. That makes it more like a traveler's check. Traveler's checks are redeemable back into official currency. And these are a couple examples that I mention in my book, Money. And you can read more about that. Well, selling a currency for cash does provide a no-interest loan. The money that's deposited into the Portuguese account, right? That gets deposited into a bank somewhere and earns interest, but no interest is paid on the credits that you have on your account. So converting national currency to a local currency can provide low interest or no interest financing. And it substitutes a universal currency for a local one, which promotes buy local. And it provides a cash pool that can be invested to earn some income. Here's a pictorial representation of that process. You got the municipality, the business or association, and you got the buyer of the currency. The buyer of the currency gives up cash and returns, or gets in return, currency credits. Now again, you've got the local merchants that will accept the community currency in return for goods and services. And the local merchants can also get goods and services, and eventually the community currency comes back to the issuer. Not necessarily in return for cash, but in return for goods and services, or in the case of a municipality, tax receipts. So there's no need for cash redemption. You can redeem in kind. A municipal government can issue credits as prepayment. We'll skip over that. It's not particularly pertinent. Now, what about the forms of presentation? We spoke about a ledger system or paper notes, but you could also have endorsed paper checks that could circulate. When I buy something from you against my account, I could just write you a check. You could endorse the check and pass it on to someone else in return for something you want. It could also be in the form of smart card balances. When I was in China last September, I was teaching English at a university for a few weeks, and there you buy a card for use in the various campus stores and cafeterias. And it's a stored value card. So you put in a certain amount, and when you go to the store to buy something, you put your card in the reader. They put in the amount of the purchase, and it gets deducted from your card. So it's like an electronic wallet. Or it could be all web-based with web accounts and credits being uploaded and downloaded. So the advantageous outcomes of a community currency are that they circulate throughout the local area, supplementing the supply of scarce official money, which enables more trading to take place in the local community at lower cost, and it enables local businesses to better compete with large corporate chains. Further, community currency credit remains in the community, doesn't go outside. The credits are readily available because we create them in the process of exchanging goods and services among ourselves. We don't have to wait for a central bank to create them. Local businesses can create as much as they need. And it reduces our dependence upon borrowing money at interest. Now, why do currencies sometimes fail? Primary reason is failure of reciprocity. You remember the other night I said, the purpose of a currency is to mediate or facilitate reciprocal exchange, where you get as much as you give, and you give as much as you get. Reciprocity can fail in many ways. First, through over-issuance of a currency, by improper issuance of a currency that is without adequate foundation, by lack of accountability and transparency, so that people can't determine what the currency is worth. But there's another reason, and that's limited number of participants and the narrow range of goods and services being offered within the community circuit. Most LET systems suffer from this. They're too small, and the range of goods and services being offered is too narrow to really make it worthwhile. So people lose enthusiasm after a while, and they drop out. And the other reason, going back to the chart that I showed of the supply chain, failure to include members from all levels of the production and distribution circuit. We need wholesalers, manufacturers, and basic commodity producers, as well as retailers. So if you want more information, this is where you can find it, at reinventingmoney.com. In my books and the books by E.C. Riegel and other sources that you'll find on the website. Okay, with that, we'll take some questions. You need to start with a diverse range of goods and services, which could come from a single issuer. For example, if you had Walmart as an issuer, Walmart has all kinds of goods and services that they offer. So that kind of issuer would provide a sufficient range of goods and services. But if you had, let's say, the typical LET system, maybe 150 or 200 members, and maybe you can get massage, maybe you can get home-baked bread, maybe you can get a few organic vegetables, maybe you can get your bicycle repaired. But that isn't a sufficient range. People often ask, how big does a system have to be in order to be sustainable? It's not just a matter of size. It's not just a matter of how many people are participating. It's also a matter of the range of diversity of goods and services. Can I get my car repaired? Can I buy my groceries? Can I buy gasoline for my car? So you want to be able to include things that are of everyday use to people, things that they need, not just things that are convenient or luxuries. Okay. Other questions? The economy of Oroville? Well, in the 2 weeks that I've been here, I've gotten a little bit of insight, and I've had conversations with Olivier, and I'm beginning to get some sense of it. There seems to be quite a bit here. It doesn't seem to be sustainable or very much self-sufficient. No community is ever going to be totally self-sufficient, but it would be nice if you could provide at least a substantial percentage of your needs internally. Was there some point to your question?
Well, you know this economy that used to run in the
Well, I know of kibbutzes, and I visited one once briefly.
You understand the economy there in the kibbutz, like a factory produce, give to the community, and support the community by one good factory that, for example, do computers.
Yeah.
Now, my question, Orville is very much a site of a kibbutz, a big kibbutz in Israel.
Uh-huh.
In Israel, this system of the kibbutz is doesn't work.
Uh-huh. Well,
I don't know
how the kibbutz compares to what I've described here.
No, but what you described here, you think is suitable to a society like Orville, such a small society?
I think so, especially if you bring in merchants that are outside on the fringe. You can have a mutual credit clearing system that includes non-Orevillian businesses. There's nothing wrong with that. Just get the ones that you trust, the ones that are producing things that you want. Include them in your circle.
And or how you exercise no money? But you say that you understand why mothers say no money. How you exercise this particular issue,
well,
this type of economy?
I don't think mutual credit clearing is money. Mutual credit clearing is reciprocal exchange. I don't know what mother thought money to be. Probably the only kind of money she ever considered or knew of was official money, with all of its inherent flaws and disadvantages. So, yes, I think if you can eliminate that kind of money from Orville, fine. But I think you still need reciprocal exchange. And reciprocal exchange can be mediated in the way that I described. The reality, of course, is that there's lots of money in Orville. You pay for the taxi every time you take a ride, and I have to put money in my account. I mean, it's still money, whether it's rupees or credits in the Orville accounting system, it's still money. You know, I have to pay for my lodging and my food. And I know there is a core group in Orville that has a maintenance. You have this Portus account that enables somewhat of a monastic kind of economy, but I don't think that's ever going to be the major part of Orville. I don't think it can be. I think you have to have a reciprocal exchange system. You're building a city here, and the city has to include more than just the monastic group. Anything else?
Is it your personal email?
Yeah, that's my email address.
Is it the phone number?
That's my phone number, huh?
You have this system and you make a big investment, like we want to build a house for $100 million.
Okay, a currency is intended to be an exchange medium. Savings and investment, that's a different topic. That's a separate problem. How do we save? Saving in a developed economy is actually a social process. You might have your savings in the form of a bank deposit or a stock portfolio or corporate or municipal bonds or federal government bonds. These are all obligations. They're all promises. Nothing more. So that's what we call a financial asset. A currency is one type of claim. Those things are another type of claim. We use a currency as a circulating exchange medium to facilitate the trading process. We use those other things as a savings medium. Now, when you buy a corporate bond, what happens to that money? The corporation takes that money and spends it on building its factory and buying machinery, whatever it needs to produce its product. So that money gets spent. So you have a claim against the profits of that company when you have a bond or a share of stock. Well, that kind of thing works no matter what medium of exchange you have. If you have excess community credits, more than you need to spend at the moment, you need to invest those. So we're going to have a capital market in the community currency just as you have in the official currency. You can use your community currency to buy a bond, to lend money for me to open my business, just as if you were to lend me rupees. So the savings and investment function can operate pretty much the way it does in the conventional money system. Those with surplus allocate it to somebody else who's going to use it productively and pay you back later on. Yes?
When you look at a village economy, for example, a very traditional village economy of India.
The village economy,
That makes more sense to me because those people kind of, whatever you call it in modern terms, their investment is very realistic because it was the physical work. They worked together. They produced whatever they want to produce, which can be any kind of modern production. In fact, when you talk, see, this is the problem for me to understand the modern world, that those people, whatever they produced, they did actually save part of it. And that part, saving for me in a realistic sense, let's say grains, that was used for the development economy, for example, investment. They dig ponds, big nice ponds, lakes, everything. And they were using the grains to distribute people who were in, kind of employed themselves into that. In this modern world, as soon as people think about producing something and investing something in the economy, is more or less, it's not realistic though. It's all in the paper, as you said. I don't want to touch any money either. But the problem is to put our investment, collective investment, what this community needs. For me, it is so chaotic that if you do not protect that community well, no matter what is the influence of outside. But how come those communities live very happily? Because they invested their money anyway. Money means for me their production. Let's say, I think in the form of what they have produced. And they put it together. For example, we do have nice ceremonies that whenever they had to work in the temple, they had porridge offering festival. That is, your food is assured that everyone is there gathering and they're working together for the whole village. But since that type of thing have gone out of people's mind, as soon as you want to start a system, you have said, oh, let us bring some foreign thing, which is actually from outside thing, that cannot be, or it is so good, or it is inevitable. But as soon as it comes, then I'm sure there is another drain where our lifeblood will go away.
Yeah, you're describing a non-monetary economy. And when you bring money into the equation, everything changes because now the village... What works on the scale of a village, I'm not sure it can work on a scale of a city where you have much more intricate processes going on. But I do know that there are societies that have been self-sufficient for a long, long time. Have been pretty isolated from the outside world, and as soon as the outside world impinges on them, then the social fabric disintegrates, and the relationships among people that provided for reciprocity and the general welfare begin to break down. So I don't know what the answer is to that.
Self-contained so much, and they were really clear about what they were doing, and believe me, they were enjoying their life.
Yeah.
It's a problem, because as soon as you said, oh, we have to start, if we want to bring a paper or any token, let's say, the currency, we want to call it, and that kills the real, the for me, goods and services are the money. And you want to put that thing, that value on this token, paper, plastic token, any metal, no matter what it is, or even just an account number. For me, it's an account number now.
Well, how big can a village get before that informal social process breaks down?
There were very big villages, like 3,000 people.
Well...
Community border system. What is the problem with borders?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, is to create a community barter system. But are you saying in the village they don't keep records? They don't keep track of who's getting what?
Yeah.
Well, in
It is called children milk. Women who are living on the street, the milkman can come and get some milk free of cost, and that lady or man would not like to sell that milk at any cost.
Well, that's good. There's an area, I don't know if you were at my talk the other night, but I talked about interpersonal distance. When the interpersonal distance is small, you can function on the basis of informal arrangements where you don't have to keep track at all. You know, everybody has a sense of the balance in their relationships with one another. But when you get to dealing with strangers, people that you don't encounter all the time, you have to have some way of managing this reciprocity that's more formal.
Yeah. Peanut thing, you know, dry peanut plants that they could feed their cow with, bullocks with, they can continue the journey and stay. It's not that they just wanted to close their economy in such a way that outsiders should not even buy it.
Yeah.
You know, they kept all the chavadis and chatrams. You know, the village itself is called Perimalya Chavadi. The Adenjavadi has still that building where people used as a free inn, you know. They did expanded that thing. It's not just, okay,
well, maybe somebody else would like to respond to that.
That was a village that was just offering for travelers a free fodder and the Roman African French
paper. They have nice building in Adenjavadi. That is just the central building where everyone was, the whole building was the free inn. And now it has become a nice bread. Selling bread.
Yeah, other societies and other times have had some interesting ways of taking care of people. In the Bible, it talks about gleaning. When someone harvested their field, they were told to go through it only once, not go back and get the fringes or the leavings, but to leave those for the traveler and the widows and the orphans.
So yeah, that after the cashews, no, all the villagers would enter into the cashews after the harvest. That's why, I mean, even some of the arable communities got bothered. Because, oh yeah, everyone not take their harvest and go back, then the leftover is for the community.
Yeah. Okay, anything else? All right, well, thank you for coming. I've been here 2 weeks, yeah. A little more than 2 weeks. I mean, have I gotten some new ideas? Well, I knew a little bit about Oroville before I came, but not very much. And of course, you really can't know anything about a place until you're actually there. And even then, you only see little bits and pieces of it. This place takes in a wide area, and I've only seen a small portion of it. But I did have a tour of some of the production units, so I got to see at least some of your economic activity and some of your economic potential. And it seems like there's a tremendous economic potential here. You've got some very able people with good skills producing excellent products. And you could produce more, not only for export, but also for internal use. But I think you're really going to have to create some kind of a mutual credit exchange system, some form of reciprocal exchange, in order to maximize the benefit. You know, you had that presentation on entrepreneurship by Gunther. Yeah, and I thought he gave an excellent presentation and provided a lot of good input for what might be done by Aurevillians in the way of entrepreneurship. If you want to be a relatively self-reliant community, you've got to be productive. And I think being productive, that is enhanced by some form of reciprocity. Yes, you can provide basic necessities for everybody once you're productive enough, but there should also be some measure of something extra for those who want to do the extra work and make the extra effort. But you also want to avoid wide disparities in wealth within the community, because I think that's destructive to community. Well, the prosperity is going to come from productivity. And I think if you allow people to reap the rewards of having taken the risk and put forth the effort, that'll increase the productivity. That's more than having just a mutual credit system. You have to have a system of rewards. Rewards. If someone here wants to undertake an enterprise, let's say to create a company that processes food, there's got to be some reward for doing that, especially if they're having to put their own money into it. Risk and reward is... You know, those things have to balance each other in business.
What is actually the common goal?
Okay.
It has to be happy. It's so simple. Reward, personal profit? I'm sorry. Can't spend your time on one thing. Reward is
always a come out of the Yeah. Well, people have to decide for themselves what it is that motivates them. I can't tell you that. Okay, thank you.